The mastermind who challenges the detective to a game of wits, or the honest criminal who waits red-handed at the scene. The former, he answered, was more stimulating, but usually only the latter commanded his respect. I understand it. The prince of murderers, said Papadelius, the Moriarty he waited for, would do both. Accepting fully and philosophically his inevitable end, yet still fighting with all his strength and cunning to extend his freedom to the last breath. He needed, I think, to meet a soldier. Good morning, Major. Mycroft, you look ready to drop. The stiffness in my shoulders made me wince as I ducked the plastic sheeting which camouflages Bridger's cave. It is a cheerful cave, walled with foam of festive colors, carved out by the robots which mine the trash beneath Cielo de Pajaros. Inside the cave is all clutter, the choicest treasures gathered from the trash of which Bridger his first pick, bright marbles, balls, tricycles, toy cars, chunks of dozens of dollhouses assembled into a hodgepodge palace, and mounds of storybooks stacked dense as bricks. My own more hygienic contributions add to the nest. Blankets, cushions, clothes, video players and digital readers, good paints and paper, and a shelf of real food. Rice, animal-shaped cookies, instant bacon, anything too difficult for the boy to make from mud and grass. I had a long day yesterday, I answered. The major stretched back in his rocking chair on the roof of a pink plastic castle, switching off the handheld news screen which dwarfed him like a billboard. Did you sleep? I gave a guilty wince. I napped on the flight back here from Romanova. The major always breathes deeply, as if he enjoys the taste of air itself. Are 10 kinds of trouble coming, or only 2? It's bad, sir, I answered, comfortable in company where I could say sir and have no one stare. I don't know how bad yet. Bad far away, or bad here? Both. I just spoke with Leslie Sinier. Someone very dangerous came to the house yesterday. A sensei in historical clothes named Dominic Seneschal. I know. They spent hours searching Thisbe's room. I nodded. If we're wise, we'll assume Dominic found enough evidence to know there have been unregistered strangers in that room. I eased myself into my own scavenged metal chair, between the major's castle and a white-painted cardboard box transformed into a functioning refrigerator by Bridger's power. I did my best to clean up yesterday, but we've been so comfortable in that house lately, we haven't been worrying about tiny bits of evidence like skin flakes. We aren't prepared to evade a professional. The major nodded, the relaxed but heavy nod of a patient who has already deduced the worst before the doctor works round to the word fatal. You've crossed swords with this Dominic before? I know Dominic well, though we haven't literally crossed swords. Dominic does carry a sword, though, and has killed several opponents in duels. Not an enemy we can face. It's time to move on. The veteran nodded slowly, his sigh heavy and frail at once. Yes. Is Bridger... I didn't have to finish, for light and smiles burst in through the plastic door. Mycroft! Oof! Bridger was long since too big for my lap, but he had never realized it. Aimer was just reading more of Les Misérables with me. His elbows jabbed my ribs as he climbed onto me, and his legs spilled out of the chair over mine like a hermit crab in need of a new shell. I think Jean Valjean would get along really well with Odysseus, don't you? They could talk about what it's like being on a really long journey with lots of different stages and never knowing if it's almost over. And I bet Odysseus would have lots of clever suggestions for how Valjean could disguise themselves and never be caught. Yes, they probably would. Bridger needed new pants, too, I noticed, as more centimeters of sock showed beneath ever-rising cuffs. He had just turned 13. He would begin to shoot up soon, and we would have to guess how tall he would become and teach him how to shave. Children rarely notice whether or not you're listening. I was thinking about what you were telling me before, about how the Greek heroes are beloved of the gods, and how that's sort of good, but also bad, because it means big, scary, divine things always happen to them. And they never get to rest, and everyone around them always dies, like Odysseus's sailors all die. That's what happens to Valjean, too, like they're also beloved of the gods. So I bet they and Odysseus could help each other deal with it. And Odysseus could come up with a clever way to make money and feed all the poor people in Paris. He got me. My mind strayed first to imagining what ingenious barricade Odysseus could construct. And then I saw it all. The conversation he imagined, the two wanderers breaking bread together, drawing succor from seeing another pair of eyes as tired as their own. The major gazed darkly at me, reminding me of his objections when the mining bots had dragged Les Miserables from the dump, a real old paper copy, somehow still legible. I had not had the heart to forbid Bridger to read it. But at story time, Bridger always used to turn on the waterworks, even when the bad guy died. Now we were watching the bookmark crawl millimeter by millimeter through the masterpiece which brings tears to the eyes of disillusioned adults. We all imagine happy endings to such books. Pick out the page, the paragraph, in which we would step in and pluck the innocents to safety. Only one among us actually can. All it would take is some store mannequins, the costumes, and a miracle. I don't know, I forced myself to answer. I don't know if Odysseus could get used to dealing with armies that have guns or with people who believe in one god instead of lots of gods. You know, it's very hard for people to deal with a world completely different from their own. I rubbed the boy's hair, chewing on the future in my mind. Yes, we would have to guess how tall he'd grow, and teach him how to shave, and make decisions like this for himself, not just to be a good boy and obey when we said no. Bridger's smile would not dim. Maybe Achilles couldn't get used to gun armies, but Odysseus could. Odysseus is the cleverest ever. If Odysseus can get along with nymphs and gods and goddesses and ghosts and foreigners, then they can handle Frenchmen. Probably so, but I can't see it going well. Odysseus managed to get lost for 10 years in just the Mediterranean, and up in France there's the whole Atlantic to deal with. I mussed his hair again. It's blonde, perhaps starting to dim. You know, that's a very sad book, right? Les Miserables, famously sad. Bridger hadn't learned to avoid the eyes of others, but always met them honestly. I know. Lieutenant Aymer already told me some of what's going to happen. I'll be ready when it comes. I used to forget sometimes that I was not Bridger's only pseudo-parent. Why do people like sad books? He asked. You like this book? I answered. I'd like it better if it wasn't sad. He leaned his head against my shoulder. I get mad at authors for doing that sort of thing to characters. Some books have to be sad to get across the ideas the author wants to talk about. Victor Hugo is describing a very sad part of real history. Hugo wants you to understand that moment in time, what was beautiful about it, and what was horrible. Books, even made-up stories, can't all have happy endings because they reflect the real world, and the real world isn't always happy. The major nodded, sagely slow. If history is written by winners, fiction like that is written by bystanders, trying to guess what the victims would have said if they'd survived. So what? The heedless boy elbowed me in the gut again as he sat up. Even if it's real life's fault bad things happen, that doesn't mean they aren't bad. Don't you get mad, Mycroft, Major? Whether it's fiction or real life, don't you get mad? I nodded. That's the sort of thing you can talk to the Sensei or Carlyle about. The Major leaned back, his tiny arms swinging over the chair's sides. Anger doesn't help. Men write books like that because they want history to remember, mourn, and make sure that sort of tragedy won't happen again. His voice was gentle, like an abdicated king, happy that his words are words again and not commands. Most of the characters in that story were willing to die for what they believed in. It's a good bet that, given the choice, they'd be willing to suffer what they suffered in the book, if it would ensure that you and the real world don't make the same mistakes. Bridger nodded. Not the acceptance of a man convinced, but of a child willing to accept the answers of his elders until he has time to test things for himself. "Is Thisbe here?" I asked. The boy wiped his nose on his sleeve, then pretended he hadn't. "Thisbe went to go meet that sensei, Carlyle. They're coming again."
"Good.
Did you like talking to them before?"
"No, but it was all right after."
I frowned down at him.
"Did you not like Carlyle?"
"I like Carlyle." He smiled his cherub smile, "but I didn't like what we had to talk about. This time I want to talk about something happier."
I held his eyes.
"Bridger, Carlyle's job is helping you talk about things that are hard."
"I know."
He flopped onto his side, winding me accidentally.
"I guess we can talk about hard things. We can talk about sad books that make me mad."
I smoothed his hair.
"You should talk to Carlyle about what you said to me before. How sometimes you get mad when bad things happen in real life, too. The same way you get mad at the authors of sad books. Carlyle can tell you about philosophers who talked about that, too."
"About getting mad? About thinking about the world the same way you think about a book?"
"There were some philosophers called determinists who sometimes talked about the creator of the universe as being like the author of a great scroll, where all the events of history are written out. The author of the world."
"Did the determinists..."
"Determinists," I corrected.
"Determinists. Did the determinists also get mad at God for choosing to make the world a sad book?"
"Some of them did. But others said God had a reason for writing a sad book, just like Victor Hugo did. Or that the book only seems sad because we're in the middle of it. But if you read the whole thing start to finish, you'd see a happy ending. Carlyle can tell you more."
He smiled. It was good to know that Bridger could smile at the prospect of facing a near stranger. "I like happy endings better."
I smoothed his hair once more. "Is Mama Doll here?"
"I'm here. Have some cookies."
"Yay!"
The boy picked the finest specimens from her tray of mud pies, which transformed to steaming gingerbread as they passed through his hands to mine. Mama Doll is tenderness itself, 30 centimeters tall, with rosy cheeks, bright glassy eyes, golden curls, and a permanent smile. Her tiny fingers are as adorable as an infant's until you touch them and realize that their childish thickness comes from the calluses of a decade's toil, and her apron is cheery with colorful patches when you do not think about the rips and stains beneath. I have caught her sweating as she fights to hoist a roast chicken twice her weight, or blistered to bleeding as she battles real-world cobwebs with her doll-sized broom. No human being can live without complaining even once, but she is a child's mad ideal, far beyond human.
"Are they yummy?"
Mama Doll asked, watching me with her two bright eyes.
"Yes. I've made some for the Major, too. See them?"
"Mmm." His mouth already full, the boy grabbed the pill-sized cookies from the plate's edge and passed them down. The Major accepted.
"Thank you."
"I'll have milk for the cookies in a moment. You boys just hold on."
"That'll have to wait. We need you here for this." The Major straightened in his seat.
Mama Doll reached up, and at that signal, Bridger lifted her and nestled her between his chest and mine. She is warm under that frilly skirt, precariously warm, like an infant whose new heat might wink out like a candle.
"What's up?"
The Major's silence forced me to go first. "We don't know for sure yet,
But we need to get ready in case we need to leave here soon. Bridger spat Cookie in my eye. Leave? I'm sorry. It's possible some strangers may search this area soon. We have to be ready to evacuate in case they come. I could hear the other soldiers' mutters, soft as the skittering of insects, as they gathered in a nearby little turret. "Strangers like Carlyle?" Bridger asked. I shook my head. Dangerous strangers. Bad things are happening in Thisby's Bush. People are coming there, and may come here. We need to pack up your most important things into just a few bags so you and I can carry them. "And Thisby," the boy corrected. "You and me and Thisby." The major shook his head. "No. If there are police and press involved, we won't be able to see Thisby for a while." "But, Bridger," Mama Doll stroked his cheek with her doll fingers, "remember, what's most important is that you stay safe. Nothing else matters. Right, Mycroft?" Still in Victor Hugo's spell, I choked a moment, thinking of what parents do for children. For how many generations have we had no soldiers anymore, no patriots, no proselytes, no causes to die for? Only our children. "Absolutely, sir," I answered. "Bridger's safety comes first. I know Thisby agrees. It won't be long until it's safe again, and we can see Thisby all we want. But so long as Thisby's being examined by the police, we can't risk it. And so long as there are people searching around the Bosch house, we have to be ready to run." Hands almost man-sized clutched my shirt. "But you'll still be here, right, Mycroft? You can come." I was so glad to say the words, "Of course." I stroked his hair. "No one can follow me." For that power, still mine, I thanked the distant makers of the Gyges device. "Okay, I'll do my best to pack." He gave his strongest smile. "How bad will it be if they catch me?" Only the major could face that question with a chuckle. "Not as bad as Croucher says. We have a plan. Our Mycroft canner knows a lot of powerful people, people who can intervene and protect us if need be. Canner, have you picked one yet? Which would be best to go to? The censor, Vivian Ancelet? He's got resources enough, but no ambition, and he's hiveless, so it would keep Bridger out of the hands of any one hive." I closed my eyes, using Bridger's warmth to steel myself. "When that time comes, it will be J.E.D.D. Mason." "I knew it!" Thisby's voice burst through the plastic sheeting, and the witch herself an instant later. "You do know J.E.D.D. Mason. I knew you did. You wouldn't admit it, but I could tell, the way you looked at your feet whenever you hear that name. Tell me everything you know about them, Mycroft, and I mean everything, right now." She was in her house robe, her boots half unclasped, with a pale and harried Carlyle Foster trembling in her wake. "What's happened?" the major asked at once. Since Thisby's broken explanation will not satisfy you, reader, I shall loop back now and give my best account of the encounter of that morning, which, like an eclipse, was always coming, yet still makes us quake inside when we see the cosmic clockwork plunge day into night. Chapter the 16th. Thou canst not put it off forever, Mycroft. I was not there, but those who were testify that it began as a peaceful morning, sleepy after the holiday. The sky was a vivid overcast, white as a canvas against which the endless flocks of cielo de pájaros soared tauntingly. You claim humans to have mastered the skies, but you race through them on your busy way, while we play. Cato's voice when he calls from his room is usually too soft even to be called a whisper. "Is it safe?" Like good humanists, they would have spoken Spanish here at home, which I approximate. Eureka lay, as ever, sprawled on the floor in the shadow of the Mukta prototype, ancestress of the lifeblood of our world. "Yes, Cato, it's safe.
No scary sensors today.
What about Cardi?
Upstairs, asleep.
Occam?
Occam and Leslie went to bed, too. Even the twins are out. And Sydney's upstairs on the exerciser. It's just me and Thisbe here this morning. Nobody dangerous.
Does Thisbe have their boots on?
No, they're on the sofa, drinking tea.
Envision Cato Weeksbooth sticking his toe out first, as if testing the water. Then, feeling no burn, he sweeps out into the hall. He is majestic, in his way, the white lab coat sweeping like a cape, his black hair as full as a lion's mane, though wild and stiff as if frazzled by electrocution. He is not a mad scientist. Heartless reality does not grant humans the lifespan necessary to master every specialty of science, so no one genius in his secret lab can really bring robots, mutants, and clones into the world at his mad whim. It takes a team, masses of funds, and decades. But one man can love all sciences, even if he cannot wield them. And he can inspire children with the model of the mad genius, even if he cannot live it. Dr. Cato Weeksbooth is a mad science teacher who spends what hours are not required by the Mukta system at his dear museum, plunged in the ecstasy of show and tell. He has just enough of every discipline at his command to answer almost all the children's questions, and what he does not know, he urges them to grow up and discover for themselves. I'm going to the museum. You're on duty here in 2 hours. Thisbe spends her empty mornings on the sofa by the window, staring at the sky over her chamomile. Screw that. I'm not covering for you. I just had the night shift. I'm going to bed. Let Cardi cover it. They owe me after last night.
Fair enough. I saw the video. You looked like you were going to piss your pants.
I did piss my pants. Where are my boots?
There, Thisbe pointed. Mycroft cleaned them. They stood in the corner. Cato's own design, griffin cloth, which, when active, shows in an ever-changing cycle the bones, blood vessels, skeleton, or heat signature of feet, sometimes human, sometimes beast feet, or robotic feet, elastic hinges bending as the tendons would. What schoolbook could be better?
Thisbe claims that Cato smiled, but Eureka, blind within the computer's embrace, cannot corroborate. When was Mycroft here? He asked.
They just left. They say they'll be around to help as much as possible until the threat has passed.
Then those two crazy sensors are coming back?
Thisbe slurped her aromatic tea.
The two aren't connected. Mycroft says Dominic Seneschal is a threat, but Carlyle Foster is an ally. And you believe that?
Yes, Carlyle's a good one. Leslie and I were so impressed we invited Carlyle to come back today to meet whichever of the twins we can catch or you.
You must have a session, Cato. It would do you good.
Cato must be careful latching his boots to keep the cuffs of his hospital scrubs from catching in their seal.
No thanks.
We can't fake this for you, Cato. You have to see a sensei or your shrink will put you back on clinic watch.
Eureka recalls being startled as their brother stomped the floor in his rage. How can all of you be over Esmerald already? 18 years means something to me.
No one can recall what the women said here. Perhaps nothing.
Anyway, I don't think we should let Mycroft Canner be our judge of senseiers.
Thisbe came to my defense.
You want to know what Mycroft really said?
He said that if one believed in Providence, one might believe Carlyle was sent here to help prepare us for the coming dangers.
Cato answered as you would have, reader. Mycroft shouldn't talk that way. Neither should you.
Thiz, how much danger does Mycroft think we're in?
Eureka resorts to shorthand when spooked by questions their computer cannot answer.
A great deal. Mycroft won't admit it, but I think they've met this Dominic Seneschal before.
They're the worst kind of secret sniffer, dangerous as they come, trust me. But Mycroft also doesn't think Dominic's behind this. Dominic's a side effect, not the author. There's no way to tell yet who's targeting us, but whoever it is has significant resources and malevolent intent. Malevolent intent? That's a good phrase to hear first thing in the morning. See Sniper stumbling down the stairs now, eyes vacant as a zombie's. This time of day, he would probably have mustered the baggy shirt and mop-like straw-brown wig he wore at home to keep visitors and low-ranked guards from recognizing him. But he was not yet awake enough to achieve pants. Morning, Thisbe. Morning, Eureka. Morning, murderer. Did you enjoy the party last night? Cato would not look at him. I'm not speaking to you. It'll be good publicity for the museum, throngs of kids. Wordless, Cato hurried to the door, the winds of his lab coat brushing Sniper's thighs with chill. Occam approved, you know. Would Sniper here have sounded cold or smug? It was necessary. We can't afford to have the president not trust us. Never do anything like that again. Or what? What will you do, huh? What could Cato do? He hurled the door aside, eager to slam it behind him, but froze on the threshold, confronted with a figure there, about to knock. Wai Chun? I have not met the security captain who smiled from the doorstep, but she is Cato and Eureka's cousin, so imagine Cato, but in a humanist uniform. Black, to make the bright Olympic rings of its embroidered patches brighter. Good morning, Cato, everyone. We've had a call for a security drill. Now? Cato wriggled with the urge to bolt. We just had one. I think the higher-ups want a triple check after the break-in. Can I just... Good call, Sniper cut in. We're right at shift change, so I'm not even on duty yet. A disruptive moment is the best time for a test. Likely the living doll apologized with a roguish smile for his lack of pants, and likely the captain did not mind one jot. 0717 local, 1117 universal time, I'll clock in now. Eureka, message Occam and Leslie upstairs, let them know it's a drill. Done. Thisbe dragged herself up off the couch. I'll head downstairs. Good, I'll start the clock at 0718, on my mark. Cato, you were here when the drill was called, so here you stay. Fine. Cato spun and stomped back to his lab in a huff that made even this obedience rebellion. Test my security. My security is perfect. Sniper smiled at Cato's murmur, as at the sweet babbling of a toddler. On my mark, then. Mark. I've never seen the house spring into action. Lights and sirens, bolting doors, the robots pouring forth from walls and corners like the wrathful march of ants. I have once seen from a distance the sudden blackening of the sky as the cars race in, guards upon guards, some in the city's police uniforms of white and gray-blue, some in humanist colors. A second wave in civvies rushed in from their beds and sofas in the surrounding tiers of Bosch houses whose residents are proud to add their names to the roster of Mukta's defenders. Occam's prophecies were sound. 50 guards in 2 minutes and 300 in five, who joined the automated system and the few night guards always on duty in the computer's humming depths. Soon every room in the Bosch house had a guard, and coordinated squads took up their places, each on its appointed tier of the computers which climbed down and down beneath the city's depths like the vast, true body of the iceberg, a glimpse of which will make the horror-stricken sailor dream of monsters. Troops filled the trench outside, too, chatting, cheerful in their proud routine. But Thisbe had showed us where their perimeter falls. So we dug Bridger's dwelling far beyond. We're going to break our record, Cato boasted to the house, texting over their tracker link. Sniper. Thisbe, is someone down there with you? I'm getting a stray signal. Cato. It's that sensei again. I knew it. Thisbe. Yes, our sensei is back again. Carlisle, I called them. Sniper. Again? Eureka. Smitten, I knew it. Thisbe. I appreciate the vote of confidence, Eureka, but it's really just a session. They're very good. Eureka, I'm sure. Thisbe, not like that. Occam, everyone carry on with the drill like all's normal. Sniper, what? Is there a problem? Occam,
The police called. Not our police, Romanova, Polylaws. Thisbe. Making a fuss? Occam. Someone's using the canner device. Thisbe. The canner device? Occam. They've been watching for it. Someone activated it. Here. Right here in the house. Eureka. Just now? Occam. 11 minutes ago. Cato. 11? Just before the drill? Thisbe. Getting my boots on now. Sniper. Who ordered this drill? Cato. I can't confirm. Occam. Cato, take over the automated systems. Don't let anyone know we're taking action. Just have something aimed at every non-Bosch member in the house. If anyone tries to leave, move, or access equipment, then slow them down. Make the door stick, lights fail, robots seem to malfunction. Don't let anyone realize you're doing anything, but slow them down. Cato, on it. Occam. Cardi, keep on as officer on duty. Go down with the drill captain and start checking off the levels one by one. Sniper, on it. Whose gray pants are these behind the couch? Can I borrow them? Leslie, mine. Go ahead. Occam, Eureka, assemble a master list of everyone who's here. See if there have been substitutions. No one should be here who hasn't had a background check a kilometer deep. Thisbe, I didn't see any unfamiliar faces. Sniper, me neither. Eureka, all IDs check out. Sniper, entering green wing elevator now. Occam, where are you? Occam, still upstairs with Leslie. We won't move until we know what's happening. Cato, I see 12 people out of position, mostly near each other, four groups of three, moving fast, upper tiers just under the house. They look like they're searching. Occam, ID them. Cato, on it. Should I take them out? I have clear shots on all 12. Occam, are they a threat to the system where they are? Cato, no, they're nowhere near controls, not a vulnerable area. Whatever they want, it isn't the system. They're definitely searching, systematically. Sniper, who are they? Cato sent an attachment. Thisbe. Cato, do you see the canner device? Do they have it? Cato. If anyone knew what a canner device looked like, that question might mean something. Thisbe. They might be searching for the device if it was used here. Cato. You brought Mycroft here in the first place, Thisbe. Leslie. Bicker later. Cato, do they have any tech you can't identify? Cato. Checking. Nothing extraordinary. Eureka. Incoming cars. Not our cars. Emergency system. Police. Occam. Reinforcements? Sniper. Whose? Eureka. Checking. Thisbe. Where are these stray 12, Cato? Give me a location. I'll flush them out. Occam. Not yet, Thisbe. I want to watch them. Cato, show me. Cato. Sanling. Eureka. What? Cato. They're all Sanling. The stray 12. It's our Sanling special guard. He means Chinese Mitsubishi, reader. Cato and Eureka use their Chinese parents' name for Mitsubishi. Of course, in one sense, Sanling is the Hive's real name, since a majority, slim but constant, of its members are Chinese. But the remainder of the Earth finds Mitsubishi less intimidating than pitch-strict Chinese vowels. Eureka. I trust our Sanling guard better than the regulars. Cato. Maybe. Leslie. What about our humanist special guard? Are they moving? Cato. No, they're in place. Do you want to let them know there's a problem? Occam. Give me a contact list for them, but no word yet. If our Mitsubishi special guard can't be trusted, we don't know about them either. Sniper. Should I call Director Ando or the President? Eureka. Reinforcements landing. Cato. Sanling reinforcements? Eureka. No, city police and humanists. Plus looks like the local alliance officer. Leslie. Herrera? Sniper. Someone's calling me. Yes, it's Herrera. Occam, you want to take it? Or keep pretending you're off duty? Occam. Leslie, call Director Ando. Cardi, put me through to Herrera, then call the President. Sniper. Done. Leslie. On it. Cato. Should someone call Director Huang? Thisbe. No, Cato. Where are these stray Mitsubishi 12? What level? Cato. B-117. Eureka. Reinforcements all landed. They're heading down the trench. Leslie. On hold, waiting for Ando. Cato. Thisbe, what are you doing? Why are you going toward B block? Occam hasn't ordered you to move. Occam. All right, Herrera confirms the drill was unplanned, ordered after the canner device went off. Thisbe, Herrera's forces are going to enter through your door. Get ready to guide them straight to B block. Cato. I can take these 12 down myself. Thisbe. Ditto. Eureka. Why are we trusting this alliance person more than our Sanling special guard? Occam, I don't trust anyone who doesn't talk to me first. Cato, you're sure the block where the stray 12 are isn't sensitive at all? Cato, I know my job, Occam.
Occam, good. Thisbe, ready to let Herrera's forces through? Thisbe, why my room? It's not a good time with Carlyle here. I don't see why we can't just handle this ourselves. Occam, I want to see how the two forces react to each other. We see the confrontation, see what each side does or tries, then, if there's any trouble, Thisbe, Occam, take them all down. Thisbe, with pleasure. Occam, how are things elsewhere? Drill going smoothly? Cato, we're not going to break our record. Occam, but do all the forces think everything's normal? Cato, looks like. Sniper, I'm down to H level, everything's running like clockwork. Eureka, there's another car coming, utopian system, not ours. Cato, really? Thisbe, working for Romanova? Sniper, I'm through to the president. On a scale of 1 to pissed, I'd rate them pissed. Cato, at us? Sniper, no, they're calling Ando. They think we can trust our humanist special guard, even if the Mitsubishi ones are being weird. Occam, good, I'll alert our special guard. Leslie, still waiting on Ando. Thisbe, I'm in place. Occam, should I let Herrera's forces in now? Occam, yes, in, now. Thisbe, done. Herrera doesn't want Carlyle down here in our way. Where should I send them? Occam, up to the Mukta Hall. Cato and guards can watch them there. Thisbe, right. Cato, incoming sense air, are you going to freak out? Cato, I'm fine. Eureka, new cars landed. Can anyone see them? I don't know utopian IDs. Cato, can't see from here, but the sensei's here now and I'm totally fine. See? Thisbe, bravo. Occam, Herrera confirms utopians are helping Romanova track the device. Cato, Thisbe and Herrera's force will reach the 12 Sanling in 50 seconds. Thisbe, these guys can really book it. This is fun. Cato, was that the doorbell? Leslie, the utopians. Cato, oh, should I get the door? Thisbe, you need to be ready to help me at B-117. Cato, I'm ready. Flick of a finger. Occam, may I get the door? I'm the only Bosch member up here. Occam, wait for me to come down. Cato, if they're tracking the Kenner device, it could be urgent. Occam, coming. Hold on. Cato, what's taking you so long? Leslie, we're not decent up here. Thisbe, oh, you poor things. Timing. Cato, they've run the bell again. The guards up here are getting antsy. We shouldn't keep them waiting, not if they're with Romanova. What if they have urgent news? Occam, fine. Let them in. With an eagerness which must have baffled the drill troops in the living room, Cato Weeksbooth rushed to the front door and opened it to find a lone, dark figure. Cato froze. He did not run this time. The sensei's scarf around Dominic's shoulders had given him something concrete to run from, but this stranger wore nothing so clear. His clothes were all black, as antique as Dominic's, tight breeches buttoned just below the knee, stockings, leather shoes, a swallow-tailed coat over a short waistcoat, a fine cravat. It was not the luxurious costume of Ganymede's 18th century, but simpler. A cut from the century's end, when the revolution's austerity had stripped fashions of their ornament. The embroidery was gone, frills, lace, trim, brocade, leaving the elegance of the style naked, if one can call clothing naked. Only the cloth itself and the long tails of the coat remained luxuriant, falling behind the figure like folded wings. In our age of peace, we easily forget the revolution's grim equality, whose terror prescribed the same uniform to peasant, to noble, and to the citizen who handed death to both. When Robespierre... Enough delay. Thou canst not put it off forever, Mycroft. Thou must describe the wearer, not just the suit. And so I must, master. And so I try. His is forgotten flesh, statue still except for the bare minimum of breath and necessary motions, walking, reaching. His eyes move only to search, his lips only to speak, never to smile. He does not fidget as he sits or stands, but lets his limbs lie abandoned, dead as a vehicle whose driver leaves it by the roadside. His skin is light enough to prove that Europe had some part in his ancestry, but has color to it, too. Though whether it is Mediterranean color, or something from farther around the globe's wide sweep, cannot be guessed from his face alone. His long hair is tied back, rich waves whose almost blackness makes it harder yet to guess which races mixed to birth this body for him. His clean face is beautiful, as a well-proportioned stag is beautiful. I think his eyes are black, but when I try to picture them, I remember no color, just their distant deepness as they focus, never on but past the base matter before them. A room feels cold with him in it, not because he drains it of heat, but because he seems to make none, so the air is as empty as if you were alone. He is now in his 21st year upon this earth, with a miner's sash still about his hips. But had you seen him at 7 years or younger, you would still have counted him graver than his imperial father.
How long until the next Mars launch?
He asked Cato in Spanish, his voice soft to the point of weakness, as when one talks to oneself to relieve too long a silence.
2 days, 15 hours, Cato answered automatically, like a child caught mid-daydream by the teacher.
For how many generations has the Senir Weeksbooth Bash been humanist?
I don't know. 10, maybe?
Thank you. I am J.E.D.D. Mason. The safety of your Bash and the incomparable service you provide humanity has been entrusted to me by order of all 7 hives and the will of the Alliance. I am looking for my dog. May I come in?
Cato gaped.
The man and officers murmured, and some saluted. The impulse was natural. No insignia of any kind touched J.E.D.D. Mason's black suit, but patches crowded for space on a cloth band around his right arm. The azure Lady Justice of the Cousins' Chief Counsel's Office, the gold-trimmed red and green trefoil of the Mitsubishi Executive Directorate, the 6 Olympic-colored swords of the Humanist Attorney General, the Gordian knot of Brill's Institute, the amphitheater ringed with stars of the European Parliamentary Council, the blue and gold scales of the polylegal bench, and Romanova's earth-blue circle, bisected by a belt of gray, which marks a gray law hiveless tribune. All these patches ringed the main symbol on the armband, a Masonic square and compass in black against iron imperial gray, the mark of a familiaris regni, an intimate of the emperor. While Martin Gildbreaker's familiaris armband is plain, this one had borders, stark white bands at the top and bottom, edged with the blood-purple piping which marks out the porphyrogene, one born the purple, a mason's child.
I guess you'd better come in.
Cato backed into the house, leading J.E.D.D. Mason and his 2 tribunary bodyguards through the separate trophy hall to Mukta's sanctum. This guest would not have seemed to glance at the articles and papers framed on the walls he passed, but he would remember every one.
Sniper texted, "Don't talk to them, Cato."
Cato texted back, "But it's Xiao Hei Huang." The Chinese have their name for J.E.D.D. Mason, too.
Sniper, don't talk to them. The president warned me about this.
Cato,
how do I not talk to them? They're a bailiff and a tribune. They're in charge of the case.
The president and Chair Kosala were on the news saying Xiao Hei Huang's in charge of the case.
Cato and our guest reached the Mukta chamber now, where the drill troops crowded in wonder around this most elusive prince.
Tribune Mason, the highest-ranked officer, hailed the visitor in English and by his most neutral name. What an unexpected honor having you here in person. You could have just called.
Only the subtlest motion of his eyes proved that he turned his attention to the speaker.
These bodies have so few senses. How can you be content with less than all?
Those around the guest froze in confusion, since his lack of tone made it impossible to guess whether the question was rhetorical.
"Well said," Eureka trumpeted over the public line.
Without moving, the visitor lowered his eyes to the set. Oklahoma Turner has a new essay on whether computer interfaces are artificial senses or prostheses to the standard 5. You will enjoy disagreeing with it. Perhaps Eureka smiled here, puckering the film of sensors across their lips like half-shed skin. That's a good way to put it. I enjoyed disagreeing when Turner argued against there being meaningful data in intuitively sensed recurring number patterns. Idiot. Do you draw strong meaning from the recurrent patterns of your habitat, as brillists do from mines and geologists from stone? Heh, strong's an understatement. Only Eureka remembered his next question precisely. Are both this home set's Pythagorean? You mean Cartesian, Cato corrected. He did not, but would not contradict. Sniper texted, Occam, get Cato and Eureka out of there, now, now, now! Occam Sinir leapt down the stairwell as quick as a god appearing at the invocation of his name. He had pajama bottoms and one sock, and had seized his sidearm from the bedside table, but the rest of him was naked, Leslie's doodles fresh on his chest and lithe bronze back. Fear and obedience warred with curiosity in Cato, but fear won, and he helped Eureka to the lab's locked door. Now Occam faced the visitor, his sock and pajamas against the high insignia of every government. But if Occam hesitated, it was the visitor's strange gaze that chilled him, not his offices. I am Occam Sinir. Whatever your charge from Romanova or any other power, Council Mason, I am in command in my house unless my president orders otherwise. Your devotion sows respect, J.E.D.D. Mason answered. I know something of your present small crisis. Would action or inaction on my part be more helpful? Occam took a breath to consider. Meanwhile, Thisbe texted, Victory! Our stray Mitsubishi 12 have surrendered to me and Herrera. They're acting natural, saying they came up here following signs of an intruder. Could be true. Sniper. Fishy. I'll come to you, Thisbe. Cato, any signs of an intruder near B-117? Cato, checking. I abridge further texts as we move our focus to the guest above. You may trust Sniper with their loyal humanist special guard and Thisbe with Romanova's honest reinforcements to secure the safety of all things. Occam breathed deep as he faced the new arrival. My small crisis seems to be contained, though you would help me if you shed light on the reason for it. I can attempt. J.E.D.D. Mason's eyes rolled slowly across the rapt, excited faces in the room. I love openness, but trust your judgment whether I should shed my light in front of all these gathered. Secrecy is one of your Bash's armors, is it not? Occam paused, then smiled at the courtesy, and turned to the nearby captain. Ju Wei Chun, isn't it? Clear the room, and pause the drill. Keep everyone in place exactly where they are, just hold position. Nobody moves without my order except the humanist special guard and Herrera's people. Captain Ju's face grew bright with questions. Oh, is Officer Herrera here? Occam raised one dark eyebrow, but the guest spoke first, his gaze now on the captain. You need not wound yourself so. The captain shook. What? Some people find that half-lies and omissions do not wound their consciences as direct lies do. But clearly, you are no such person. You wound yourself with this deception. Rest in silence. You will suffer less. Occam's face and voice grew black as storm. What do you mean? Remember, reader, there is no intonation in J.E.D.D. Mason's words, so these men have no way to guess what side he takes, or why he exposes what he does. The name Herrera that you spoke, Member Sunir, was no strange news to this person. It must be some very deep love to compel such painful self-injury. With these words, a transformation seized the captain. A sob rose in her throat, grief on her lips, while tear glints kindled in her eyes, her whole face flushing with that blood-red passion blush which flares so intensely in some Asian faces. The tribunary guards jumped closer to their ward as Occam raised his sidearm, though he aimed away from J.E.D.D. Mason, at the captain, who gave a second sob. "Why anger?" J.E.D.D. Mason asked Occam flatly, as if he genuinely struggled to understand. "Only a great good would move such an exacting conscience to this action." He turned his eyes on the trembling captain. "Was it charity? Gain for many? Protection for many? Lessen the sum total of human pain at the cost of increasing yours?" Occam cut him off. "My interrogation, Tribune, not yours. Explain yourself." He took one grim pace toward Zhu Wei Chun, his bare arm and weapon steady, with the rare phrase "deadly force" behind both. "The other forces here bear no such privilege, not even the tribunary guards, expert with the stun guns that law judges sufficient to guard the highest officers of the Alliance, but not enough to guard the precious cars." Captain Zhu choked down a sob. "I'm sorry, Member Sunir. It's nothing hostile, I swear. It was the least disruptive way to remove the threat. Or it should have been." She winced, looking around to her baffled fellows. "Can we clear the room?" "Use text." Zhu Wei Chun hesitated. "You will not want this to leave a record." Occam Sunir took a deep breath, then announced his orders over his tracker, and aloud, "Cardigan, bring our humanist special guard up here. I want people I can trust. Wei Chun, surrender your weapons. You too," to the tribunary guard. "I appreciate your backup." His eyes did a quick count sweep and settled on the one warm body unaccounted for. Not the visitors. "Cousin Foster." The young sensei had tucked himself into the most out-of-the-way sofa, watching all with that fascination which draws crowds to a flaming house. "I can leave if you like, or stay," he offered. "No need to worry about security with me. I'm used to high-security bashes. That's why I'm here." He gave a strong, calm smile, for our Carlyle had risen full of strength that day, March the 25th, the first day of the medieval new year. A festival of spring, as well as the Feast of the Annunciation, a day on which men had honored their Creator in many ways in ages past, and still do today. There must have been some little sign from red-faced Zhu Wei Chun. A breath, a twitch, a glance. Reason insists there must have been, to prompt J.E.D.D. Mason's next words. "Let the sensei stay. Their presence doubles confession's benefit." Occam turned, a precise, too energetic movement, his body beneath the bare skin tense with that rare energy that reminds us humans once were predators. "What?" "Confession addressed to you will heal the peace and your confusion, and perhaps your trust. But if a priest attends, confession will also lift weight from this sin-fearing person's wounded conscience." J.E.D.D. Mason's eyes rolled down to Captain Zhu. "Will this sensei suffice? If you prefer one with some formal ordination, my Dominic can serve. If he is found. Or I could call Guiomar Capello." The name made both the captain and Carlyle twitch, since, in our age of theological anonymity, no sensei is more widely suspected of being a secret Catholic than the personal sensei of the King of Spain. A baffled awe mixed with fear and shock on Zhu Wei Chun's face, unlocking tears in the catharsis of deception's end. How did you know? That drove Carlyle to his feet.
"You can't," he cried, then paused, as if he was himself uncertain how to phrase his objection. "You can't just say things like that, in front of people." J.E.D.D. Mason did not turn, but his black eyes rolled around to fix on Carlyle as when a too lifelike painting seems to track you across a room. "You believe in non-interference. Is that not incompatible with benevolence?" Carlyle went white, holding his wrap tight about himself, as if some trespassing gale had caught him wet and almost naked to the storm. "No." Nothing changed in the visitor except his words. "But I misunderstand. By can't, you did not question the possibility of my words. You meant I should not say such things under local human law. You are correct. I erred. I thought only to diminish present pain. But I concede and recognize that the laws and master of this house are not wrong to rank duty over pity." His eyes drifted to Occam. "I apologize, Member Sinier, for this mismatch in the radii of our consequentialisms." The room fell silent. We are unaccustomed, reader, to words like his, which cut through the surface levels of our interactions to the reality beneath. Only Occam had the strength to smile. "No need to apologize. It was a handy and original way to expose a conspiracy." Still no expression. "Should I repeat the action? Conspirators are, by definition, plural." Fear touched every face but those of Occam and the tribunary guards. The master of the house phrased his invitation carefully. "If Wei Chun has co-conspirators, I want to know it." One by one, the drill troops held their breath as J.E.D.D. Mason's dead eyes rolled across them. On the third, a slender Dutch Greenpeace Mitsubishi football player stationed by Cato's door, they stopped. "Which karma do you want?" he asked. It is hard to name the expression of abject contact, more shocked and intimate than fear, which seized her face. With slow and careful hands, she released the clasp which held her weapons belt and let the whole fall to the floor. Three others followed suit. Occam released a slow whistle, while Carlyle, tiptoeing forward from the sofa, gave a deeply shaken little gasp. Leslie texted, "Occam, I'm finally live with the President and Director Ando. They say this drill was ordered by someone mid-ranked in our Mitsubishi backup. As a stupid plan for going after whoever has the canner device. Apologies are flying, and the President's in full-fledged righteous fury mode. Shall I add you to the call?" Occam, "Is anyone trying to defend or justify this debacle?" Leslie, "No." Occam, "Then no need yet." Sniper entered now with a humanist special guard. These 12 were all humanists by hive and birthbash, mostly natives of Cielo de Pajaros, proud of their commissions, excited by the drill, and even more excited now that something real was happening. Their calm faces and Sniper's presence eased Occam instantly, like sea spray in the heat of August. They also eased the 5 conspirators in a way, since surrender doesn't feel so real when you outnumber those you're trying to surrender to. Occam's quick orders sent the regular troops and secondary prisoners off to part secure until the room was almost what he wanted. Trusted Sniper, trusted troops, the oddly forthright traitor Zhu Wei Chun, all in Occam's control save for the little sensei, this strange guest, and his honor guard. And Thisbe. Her arrival in Sniper's wake did not match Occam's orders, a fact which earned a twitch of irritation from his black brows. But he would not criticize a Bosch member in front of outsiders, nor would Thisbe, in any circumstance, admit why she had more reason than any of them to want to get the measure of this new intruder. "Hink?" J.E.D.D. Mason began in Latin, but caught himself. "From this point," he translated,
Do you desire help or privacy?
Occam smiled appreciation at the great Prince Tribune's deference. I understand high politics is your thing. If you can sort out that,